The Last Street Novel by Omar Tyree. Narrated by Richard Allen. Copyright 2007 by Omar Tyree Incorporated. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Omar Tyree and the Watkins Loomis Literary Agency Incorporated, and was produced in the year 2007 by Tantor Media Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Harlem, 2006. The smoke from the cigarette rose to the unblemished young face of a Harlem street general. He took another toke, holding the slim white cancer stick to his dark brown lips in between the fingers of his left hand. On his wrist dangled the overpriced timepiece of a pink gold Rolex, face all broken out with diamonds. His eyes squinted from the smoke while he stared forward, and when he spoke, he possessed the full confidence of authority.
"I heard you had a whole lot to say about me. What you got to say about me now? You still got a mouthful you want to spit out?"
He was real easy with his movements, relaxed like a pool shark who knew he'd win. He was 25, but his baby face and wiry frame made him look closer to 20. He wore a beige tennis shirt and top-grade denim jeans, held up by a leather belt with a chrome belt buckle with the capital letter G. When he walked forward, a black semi-automatic pistol, elongated by a silencer attachment, tapped against his right leg. The pistol and silencer were firmly secured in his black leather-gloved shooting hand. Several of his trusted soldiers surrounded him in a lineup to his left and right, leading to their prisoner, who sat in the middle. And a dim light slashed in from the top of the blacked-out windows, good enough for them all to see, while no one could see them. Their prisoner, a too-late depraved victim of disrespectful swagger, was strapped to a wooden chair with duct tape wrapped around his mouth to muffle his screams. The duct tape also served to stop him from ratting out any more information. That was why the man was in trouble in the first place. He knew too much, and he wasn't afraid to say what he knew. The young general reached him at the chair and smacked the man upside the head with the hard handle of the gun. Clack! The man dropped his head and whimpered in pain. One of the soldiers looked on and grinned.
"I bet he ain't gonna talk that shit no more."
They were inside a run-down storefront property off Adam Clayton Powell Boulevard, north of 125th Street, and away from the foot traffic that flooded their popular neighborhood. They were all in their reckless late teens and young twenties, well-groomed, all except for the tattered prisoner. He was in his early 30s and nappy-headed, with his last haircut performed by the barber over a month ago.
"Oh, that's no doubt," the young general stated.
He backed away from the prisoner, far enough to aim the extra-long barrel at his face. He then took another puff of his cigarette. He said to no one in particular,
"You know what I always wondered about these silencers? I mean, if you can't really hear the bullet when it comes out, then how you know if it hurt or not?"
"A knife don't make no sound, but you know that shit hurt. Especially a military knife that got them jagged edges on them," another one of his soldiers said.
"But that's the wrong answer. The right answer is, you gotta read their eyes. Like it said in Scarface, the eyes, they never lie. So watch this motherfucker's eyes when I shoot him."
He aimed the gun at the man's forehead and paused for the reaction, but there was none.
"You see that? He trying to play brave now. He don't even want to blink. But watch his eyes after I shoot him in his toes."
He flicked his nearly finished cigarette away and aimed down at the prisoner's shoes, firing without hesitation. The silent bullet zipped through the front end of the man's left shoe and sent him into a chair-rocking frenzy.
"Grr!"
he growled through the duct tape that was secured around his mouth. The man's eyes tightened in a flash as if someone had squirted them with lemon juice. The young general got excited, proving his point.
"You see what the fuck I'm talking about? He ain't playing it cool now.
Let me see what his eyes look like when I shoot him in his arm."
Another silent bullet ripped through the flesh of the prisoner's left arm, which was strapped to the back of the chair. The man shook his matted head and squeezed his eyes shut in excruciating pain.
"This probably how they doing motherfuckers in Iraq right now."
"That'd be a good torturer," the young general joked.
"You gotta keep it entertaining when you do it. Ain't no sense in being mad about it. We got the motherfuckers now. So I could fuck around and shoot him in his ear and let him feel his blood dripping down his eardrum."
A few of his soldiers winced.
"You sick, son,"
a brave one commented with a shake of his head. Fortunately, the young general didn't pay him any mind. For the time being, it was kill one mockingbird at a time.
"So what, you want it in your head or in your chest, man?"
"You make your choice, I don't mind,"
he teased the prisoner, who was bleeding from his left foot and left arm. The unfortunate older man continued to keep his head down, not willing to volunteer anything to the game. That decision forced him to take another bullet, this time to his left earlobe. He growled and shook his head hysterically. The young general became angry like a psychopath.
"Nigga, you listen to me when I'm talking to you. You hear me? Or you ain't gonna hear shit else in here."
Nobody laughed or said a word at that point. Their leader was in psycho mode.
"Shit. Now I gotta talk to you in your good ear."
His wry comment broke the tension in the empty room, compelling his soldiers to laugh out loud again. The young general walked over to the prisoner's right ear and stopped to address his set.
"Hey, ain't nothing fucking funny in here. I'm about tired of this shit now. And you look at me when I'm talking to you, Eugene."
He called the prisoner by his first name and aimed the gun to his forehead again. Eugene slowly lifted his head and forced himself not to beg for mercy. He realized that his begging would be useless. It would only add more fuel to an ugly fire.
"Now you got something else to say out your mouth about me on the streets, huh? About how I don't know shit? About how I ain't got shit on lock? About who's supposed to be pulling my fucking strings? You got something else to say now?"
Eugene shook his head and sniffed. Fresh snot ran out of his nose, mixed with tears that ran down his face in a combined slop of terror, while blood painted the side of his neck from the bullet that shot off his earlobe. The young general snapped.
"I thought not."
Then he made his whole point of the evening.
"Nigga, I'm not no fucking game. So when you hear somebody say Baby G, don't take that baby shit seriously, 'cause I'm a grown-ass man now. And I don't make fucking music, but I will make a motherfucker dance. You hear me?"
He was speaking more to his set of soldiers than to Eugene. Eugene was a dead man. He was no more than a human blackboard on which Baby G was writing his message. But instead of chalk, he was using bullets.
"Aight, son, so where you want it? In your head or in your chest? 'Cause I got shit to do."
Eugene stretched his eyes in disbelief. Baby G read it and frowned at him.
"Aw, now I know you don't think you was gonna live in here. What you think, I'm gonna let you walk around deformed and crippled? What if somebody asks you what happened? What you gonna say? You got caught up in a drive-by? We can't have no drive-bys in Harlem. That shit is way too sloppy. Somebody fuck around and hit Bill Clinton by accident, and these beatwalkers will fuck up the whole neighborhood looking for niggas. They'll turn us into Jews for a new Holocaust."
He said, "'Cause Harlem is changing now, B. These adventurous-ass white folks is moving in and running up the property value with these new condos and shit. So now we gotta do our shit underground. Silencers, leather gloves, and shit like that."
He looked over to his soldiers and said,
"Hey, they even shutting down the liquor store game and putting up coffee and cake shops on every corner now. Fucking bagel and Philadelphia cream cheese shops and shit."
His set started laughing again.
"Word up, son. That shit is real. Got me drinking coffee and shit now."
One of his soldiers agreed, while the rest of them nodded in unison. Baby G looked back at their prisoner of war and said,
"I bet you ain't think I knew shit like that, did you, Eugene? You just thought I was another young dumbass criminal, huh?"
He stopped and eyed Eugene in his face, stooping down to get his point across with the silencer.
"Nah, B, I know shit. So I figured I'd educate your ass before I kill you.
His soldiers stopped laughing after that. Playtime was over. It was killing season.
So where you want it? In your head or in your chest?
Baby G backed up and repeated.
Come on, son, let's make it happen. Let's get it over with.
When Eugene failed to answer, the young general wiped his hands of the whole scene.
Fuck it. It's your head, then.
He squeezed off two more shots. The silent bullets splattered through the back of the man's skull and left him limp in the chair. Baby G then tossed the gun to one of his soldiers.
Do something smart with that and burn the glove. Oh, I'm gonna have to burn you.
I got it,
his soldier assured him calmly. Baby G nodded.
That's good.
He turned and headed toward the back door to make his exit the way they had all entered.
Yo, somebody give me another cigarette.
When they walked back out into the tranquil night air, bright stars and a half moon were out. Everything was good. Harlem was an every night holiday in the summertime. The streets were always flooded with the celebration of life, and there was no other place in the world they would rather have lived. Baby G continued to nod. A fresh cigarette rose to his lips in between the fingers of his right hand.
Yo, let's ride in that Mercedes with the top down. I feel like meeting me some new girls tonight. What's going on in zip code?
Somebody answered.
They got that comedy aisle going on there tonight.
Baby G thought it over. Comedy was good.
Aye, that's good money. Girls love to laugh. But let's smoke some of that sour diesel first. The laughs come easier with the weed.
That's what's up, another one of his soldiers agreed.
I'ma go get that. And hurry up with it, too.
They eased their way down Adam Clayton Powell Boulevard toward the black Mercedes CLK convertible and a Chrysler 300 that were parked a few blocks away. Times Square. At 6 o'clock in the morning, throughout the streets of Manhattan, New York, yellow taxis zoom through light traffic, carrying early bird employees and managers along the empty sidewalks of 1,000 high-rise buildings that cluttered the Big Apple. And on nearly every Midtown street corner, newsstands and food and refreshment joints set up shop for another busy day feeding the local patrons and tourists who buzzed in and around the city. At the corner of 7th Avenue and 52nd Street stood the towering Sheraton Hotel, close by Times Square. A simple walk south on 7th Avenue would deliver you right smack into 42nd and Broadway, with all the bright lights, billboards and attractions, including where the stars hung out. Actors, writers, directors, producers, comedians, musicians, athletes, dancers, fashion designers, and your popular business moguls. The Sheraton Hotel was a centrally located New York hotspot, a place for those who wanted to be close to the action. And Sharif Crawford was one of them, a best-selling author of romantic fiction who was still young and athletic enough to run with the wild horses. As the first light of dawn cracked through the curtains of his luxurious suite, his circadian rhythm began to kick in and awaken him. No alarm clock was needed. The hustle was the hustle, and his body had gotten used to his early rises a long time ago. So he opened his eyes and stretched his dark brown arms over several extra fluffy white pillows in his room up on the 22nd floor of the West Wing.
Ah, he grumbled. Another day, another dollar. Another fine girl, another holla,
he rhymed to himself in sing-song. He rolled over on his back in the comfortable king-size bed and looked up at the ceiling. He was wrapped snugly inside the expensive white quilts of the author's suite and sinking into the bed like a fly in sticky buttermilk. A large cherry-wood bookshelf stood against the wall to the right of the bed beside a tall reading chair and matching footstool. Various first editions, hardback novels by national best-selling authors, filled the shelves.
including John Grisham, Stephen King, Elin Harris, Michael Crichton, Terry McMillan, Anne Rice, Nora Roberts, Amy Tan, Dan Brown, and Danielle Steele.
Before he checked out of the hotel, Sharif wanted to add one of his own books to the collection. He figured he had earned it. It was the first day of his 7th book tour, which always kicked off in his hometown of New York, the city that never sleeps, and he was being pampered as requested. He peeped over at the clock on the nightstand. It read 6:17 a.m. His limousine and driver would arrive at the hotel for pickup at 6:45. His first interview that morning was at 7:30. The producers of the morning news at New York Cable Network, NYCN, wanted him at their Manhattan-based television studio by 7:15, and although the interview would last no longer than 5 minutes, it was well worth it. African-American writers could rarely count on television time in New York City, but Sharif could. He was special that way, and the ladies loved him. So he used what he had to use, his sex appeal and uninhibited imagination, to make himself into a millionaire. "Damn, it's fucking time to go already," he mumbled as he continued to watch the clock. He was still feeling a slight hangover from too many drinks at the bar, entertaining old friends at TGI Fridays the night before. He gave himself another 5 minutes, another 3, and another 2 before he finally forced himself out of bed at 6:27 and jumped into the shower. At 6:49, the limousine driver, a light brown black man in his early 30s, wearing a dark suit, white shirt, and bright tie, looked down at his watch and began to wonder if he should call up to his client's room. He stood outside a shiny black Lincoln Town Car parked at curbside on 7th Avenue. In his right hand, he held the itinerary for the day, with Sharif Crawford's name, cell phone number, and the date printed at the top of the first page of 3. In his left hand, he held a hardback copy of Sharif Crawford's latest novel, The Full Moon. On the cover jacket, an attractive couple embraced passionately on a moonlit beach. The limo driver smiled and thumbed through a couple of the pages. His wife was an avid reader and fan of Sharif Crawford's novels, so he was a little excited to meet the author. The man's books had served to spice up his sex life at home. "This gon' make Carlita's day," he told himself, grinning while he waited. After another minute of wavering, he decided to call Mr. Crawford to make sure he was up on time that morning. He pulled out his cell phone and dialed Sharif's number. Sharif sprayed Sean John's Unforgivable cologne into his hands and rubbed the scent on his neck, chest, shoulders, and lower torso before he slid his wife-beater tank top over his shoulders. He stared into the large mirror over the cherry wood dresser and boasted, "It looks like another good day. Damn, it looks good." He took a strong whiff of himself and added, "Smells good, too." He slid on a white button-down cotton shirt with no tie before his cell phone rang. He pulled his phone from the holder that was attached to the dark blue dress pants he wore and read the 917 area code before he answered the call.
"Hello? Yeah, my name is Daryl Moreland, and I'm your limo driver for the day. I just wanted to make sure that you were ready. We're not running late yet, but..."
Sharif cut him off and said,
"Perfect timing, Daryl. I'm coming down right now."
"Oh, okay. Good. We got about 20 minutes to make it over to the station."
"All right. I'll be right down."
Sharif closed the cell phone, slid it back into its holder, and took a seat on the edge of the bed. He reached forward and grabbed his dark blue alligator shoes and slipped them on. He tied the gaiters up, grabbed his camel-colored sports jacket, and stood back up to slide his arms and shoulders in. He looked into the dresser mirror one last time while grabbing his brown saddle leather briefcase.
"Let's go get it," he told himself in the mirror. He checked his pants pocket to make sure he had his hotel key card. Once he confirmed that he did, he was out the door. Sharif arrived at the lobby floor of the Sheraton Hotel and walked out of the elevator with swagger to burn. The security guard at the elevator nodded and greeted him. "Good morning, brother." Sharif looked like a man of importance. He walked like a VIP, dressed like one, and smelled like one. And he didn't take his good fortune for granted, either. The privileges of wealth were definitely a good thing. "Hey, you have a good day, man," he told the security guard.
"You too."
"Oh, you know that. I feel good this morning. It's time to do what I do." An attractive young white woman looked him over curiously as she walked out behind him. "Who is he?" Sharif caught her stare and responded accordingly. "Yeah, you look good this morning too," he flattered her. She grinned sheepishly.
"Oh, thank you."
"Have a good day," he told her.
"Oh, yeah, you too."
Sometimes recognition was all a person needed to start off their day with a bang. Sharif strolled out the front doors of the Sheraton in his immaculate attire, with briefcase in hand, and spotted his limo driver at the curb. It looked like a day for bright sunshine in July. And that's what it was. A bright and sunny day in New York City. Forecast for a high of 89 degrees. "Hey, brother, you ready to make this trip to the station?" The limo driver nodded to him and smiled. "I've been ready, but I can't leave without you." Sharif walked down to the curb where the black Lincoln Town Car was parked and said, "Well, let's do it then. We got people who want to see me on TV this morning." The limo driver perked up and opened the back door of the car. There was a certain pride in chauffeuring another young black man. Even if he didn't get tipped well, it felt good to see another brown man move up the ladder of American class, and for something positive and intellectual at that. The book business was historically an aristocratic white folks' business, and as high class as golf, tennis, and traditional country clubs before Tiger Woods and the Williams sisters broke in. So as soon as Sharif was comfortably seated in the black leather seats inside the limo, Darryl Moreland told him, "Now, I want to get this out of the way bright and early so I won't have to bother you any more today, brother." He stopped and held out the new book in his hand. "Could you please autograph this book for my wife? Her name is Carlita. She loves your work, buys everything you put out. And after that, I won't bother you no more today. I'm just your driver." Sharif took the book and laughed. "Nah, man, you are more than just a driver. You got a wife. You probably got kids. You got a job. You doing what a man is supposed to do, and I respect the fact that you respect me and what I'm doing, so it's all good." Darryl said, "Well, I haven't read any of your books myself, but I don't really read these kinds of books. But as long as my wife is happy with it, that's all that really matters." Sharif paused and decided to let the comment slide. Just keep the peace and move on in silence. "Yeah, you gotta keep the ladies happy these days," he responded. "Somebody's gotta do it. That's who I write for." He then took out a Cartier pin from inside his sports jacket and asked, "How do you spell Carlita?" "C-A-R-L-E-T-T-A," the driver spelled out for him. Sharif nodded and autographed his latest novel with his favorite pen, a gift from his editor. He was awarded the platinum pen after reaching his first 100,000 mark in hardback sales in 2000 for I Want More, the sequel to Chocolate Lovers, published in 1996. I Want More was also the book that landed Sharif his first seven-figure contract. The exact numbers were undisclosed. He didn't like people knowing too much about his income. His grandparents had told him never to reveal that information to the public. "People start thinking they know you better than what they do when they know how much you're worth," his grandfather had told him. Sharif looked back to his driver and said,
I figured that's how you spell it, but I had to make sure. You never know with our people's creativity. I had a girl get mad at me one time in Detroit for spelling her name J-A-N-E. You know how she spelled it? J-A-I-N. Like pain, and she expected me to know that. They shared a laugh before he handed the signed book back.
No, we don't allow no crazy spellings in my house, Darryl told him. I got two little girls named Jennifer and Jessica, and their names are spelled correctly.
Are they twins?
Nope, 2 years apart.
Sharif's wife of 11 years was named Jennifer, but he decided a long time ago to keep his private family life out of his public affairs as well, so he didn't bring it up.
Darryl said, Well, let's get going, Mr. Crawford, and thanks a lot for signing this book for me. My wife is going to flip for this.
He climbed behind the wheel and added, You're going to get me some good love tonight, brother. Thanks. They laughed again before pulling out into traffic on 7th Avenue. A young assistant met up with Sharif while he sat comfortably inside the green room at the NYCN television studio.
You want any coffee or anything? She asked him.
No, I don't drink coffee. I got a natural high, he told her.
The assistant chuckled. I guess that's a good thing to have. You're always up and going. I have a few friends like that.
Are they successful people? He asked her.
She stopped and thought about it.
Well, yeah. I would pretty much say they were successful.
He nodded. That's the basic rule of life. The busiest worms eat the most apples, and they don't drink caffeine.
She nodded back to him and grinned. She understood that she wasn't on that busiest worm level, so she left his philosophy alone.
Well, what about water? She asked him.
He grabbed the white paper cup that sat on the table beside him and took a sip.
I already got it, he told her.
Oh, well, you're very low maintenance, I'll tell you that, she commented with a chuckle.
Sharif smiled at her with nothing left to say. He figured he would save the rest of his charm and wit for the morning news hosts and their cameramen.
I'll be back in a minute to get you, the assistant informed him.
Okay.
The time was 7:27, and Sharif was scheduled to go on air in less than 5 minutes. When the assistant returned to the room, they were ready for him.
Okay, we're ready for you, she told him.
Sharif walked out of the green room behind her, and as soon as they entered the recording room, with all the cable wires, 3 large cameras, and several colorful background sets, a makeup artist checked the radiance of his skin and touched him up with dark brown powder to take away his shine. Sharif then looked over at Heather Cook, the entertainment host. She was a mixed-race, cream-colored woman with long, dark hair and sharp features. Sharif's old friends from the neighborhood had told him about her the night before at Friday's when he told them about his interview that morning.
That girl Heather Cook is bad. You might want to try and slide her your number after the interview, son. Hooking up with her would be good money, they told him.
And they would all be watching, including his grandparents, who had recently moved to Harlem's West Side in Morningside Heights near Columbia University. Hundreds of thousands of New Yorkers loved to watch the New York cable network news in the morning. NYCN gave them a stronger rundown on the local news and events as opposed to the ABC, NBC, CBS, and Fox affiliates, who focused more on national and international news, with only a slice of the local. So plenty of urban New Yorkers would see his interview that morning. The pressures of fame never fazed Sharif Crawford. He was perfectly at ease in the limelight. He craved it, as much as he craved good-looking women like Heather Cook, who wore a dark gray business suit with a purple blouse. Yeah, she do look good. She looked like a Brazilian or some shit, which means she got some black blood in her, he smiled and assumed to himself. Right before the commercial break, Heather introduced a tease of their upcoming interview.
Next up in the world of books and publishing is a new hot summer beach read from Sharif Cross.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?